News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Donald Rosenstein about support services for patients and families faced with cancer. But first, we're going to talk about research that matters.
Well, I think this one impacts everyone, Christy. Who uses a mobile cell phone?
Almost everyone, yes.
Almost everyone, even more than the internet, and it's a worldwide. And, you know, we started thinking the other day, you know, particularly since we're talking about cancer today, what's the data about use of mobile cell phones and the risk of tumors?
So we will talk about an article that was in the Journal of Clinical Oncology.
Very good journal.
Back in November, about what data is out there regarding cell phone use and cancer.
And what usually happens, Christy, is that articles come out and they're kind of a single study, and then they get in the news and people read about, at least what I had read about a lot was, you know, that there might be a slightly increased risk of cell phone use with cancer, but I really wondered how strong is that evidence. And so this is a really good article. It's what's called a meta-analysis, where it puts in a statistically valid way all of those articles together that have been out there and then looks at what they find and then how what they find is related to the quality of the type of research that's actually done.
So in this particular meta-analysis, they looked at 465 articles that met the criteria that they were looking at to see the link between cell phone use and risk of cancer.
And this involved almost 40,000 participants, which is obviously much larger than any single study, to look at the relationships between different types of cancers and having a cell phone.
So when they pulled all this data together, they found that compared with people who never or rarely reported using a mobile phone.
Which I don't know where they found those.
I know. Who would those people be? The risk for overall use, or something called the odds ratio, and I'll let you explain that, Adam, was 0.98 for developing both malignant and benign tumors.
Which basically means that there really wasn't an association overall with your chances being increased or decreased for having a malignant tumor, whether or not you had and used a cell phone versus those who had never or rarely used it.
And another thing they commented on is really the quality of the studies that they looked at.
Yeah, so when they found that they looked at the studies of higher quality, then there was actually appeared to be an association, though the quality was not great in many of the studies. But in those that was a higher quality, it appeared that there could be a slight increased risk, about an 18% increased risk of having used a cell phone and having a malignant tumor than not ever having had a cell phone.
So I don't know about you, Adam, but I read all this to say, okay, so we've got a lot of studies that aren't very good, and it leaves me still with a giant question mark to say we don't really know.
Yeah, or if there is an association, it's not overwhelmingly strong, and I'm not overly worried about it. I do think there are common sense things. You know, I'm glad to see that the antenna that sticks out of a lot of the cell phones is no longer there for most. And so, you know, my kids, as they used to suck on the end of the antenna like a piece of candy or a lollipop, you know, I was like, that can't be good for you.
Can't be good.
You know, and with the Bluetooth technology, and you can have your cell phone perhaps a little further away from you, or speakerphones, you know, there are ways of cutting down. But again, I agree with you. I'm not overly worried. Having looked at this now.
Well, it's not going to stop me from using my cell phone anyway. I don't know about you.
I probably won't have it taped to my ear, but same with me. Well, what's our very next research that matters?
Okay, this is about soy intake. How much soy you take in your diet and any change in your risk of certain cancers.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people really interested in cutting down on their cancer risk if they can by doing natural things. And there's been some kind of mixed evidence about the relationship between soy and risk of various type of cancers like endometrial cancer or ovarian cancer. And so this was also a meta-analysis.
So they're trying to find if there are any real quantitative meaning, how much and how strong is that association between in taking soy in your diet and the risk of endometrial and ovarian cancer by pulling all these studies together.
Yeah, and this is one of the amazing things, Christy, in this type of research, that out of 477 articles that they screened, they only found 7 that met their strict criteria for really including this analysis. But that's still 7 studies. And what they actually found is consistently that the odds or the likelihood of having an increase or decrease risk was actually lower the higher the soy intake was for multiple cancers in this study, including endometrial cancer and ovarian cancer.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually. It was opposite than I would, in common sense, might lead me to think. But again, compared with the people who took in the lowest soy intake, that odds ratio or your chance of developing endocrine cancers were 0.61 of all of those cancers and 0.7 for endometrial cancer, showing, and 0.5 for ovarian cancer, suggesting there may be a protective effect of the soy intake.
Yeah, so I don't think this means if you want to lower your risk, you can go out and take soy. But I think if you have had a history of maybe an endometrial or an ovarian cancer, or you have high risk for it, you don't have to be worried certainly
right.
about this. And that's very useful information for a lot of people, I think.
Right. Certainly, we need more study to draw strict conclusions, but it's suggestive that eating soy is certainly isn't bad.
Well, let's move, Christy, from looking at cancer to looking at depression, because again, today's show, we're going to be talking about cancer and depression.
Yeah, so this is a study about sleep and its link with depression, and particularly it's focused on adolescent or teen depression to see if parents' set bedtimes have any association with the development of adolescent depression.
Yeah, you know, this looking in actually in the journal Sleep, almost 16,000 teenagers, grade 7 to 12, and looking at, you know, I've got 3 teenagers, and if I have them go to bed at the same time and at a decent time each night to ensure they get better sleep, what are their chances of being depressed or have depression compared to those that go to bed midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, what they found were these teens in grades 7 through 12 who had parents who set bedtimes of midnight or later, that they were 24% more likely to suffer from depression and 20% more likely to have thoughts of suicide than other teens who had parents who set bedtimes of 10 p.m. or earlier.
Yeah, this I think is really quite important because it really adds to this. We've covered on the show, Christy, on several different times, the importance of sleep and sleep for adults and sleep for teens. And this really shows that, you know, lack of sleep could in and of itself be an independent risk factor for something like adolescent depression and suicide.
Yeah, I mean, we've sort of known that sleep and depression can cause problems with sleep, and not getting sleep can cause you to develop symptoms of depression. And we need to understand this link more fully. But this certainly suggests to me that I'm going to take bedtimes very seriously in my family.
Well, and I know from my own standpoint that when I'm going several nights as a physician, sometimes up on call all night and you don't get your sleep for several nights, not only are you tired, you get to be a little depressed sometimes. So I think important research, we can use it, and our listeners, we hope that you use it with your family and your children.
So the last one we have is also about depression. This has been in the press about these SSRIs or antidepressant drugs and whether or not they help people who have mild depression.
Yeah, in the Journal of the American Medical Association this year, really looking at, again, a meta-analysis combining a lot of research into see, you know, does people who have mild depression benefit from antidepressant therapy more so than other ways of treating mild depression, such as cognitive behavioral therapy or simply supportive therapy? Because we know that if you got severe depression, these things really, really help.
Yeah, so they were trying to identify the magnitude of benefit. So how much does taking this medication actually make a difference on one's symptoms compared with if they took a placebo or just a pill that they didn't know that they thought was potentially an antidepressant medication? And they found that the magnitude of benefit of taking the medication really did depend on how severe the depression was.
And so if it's a mild depression, there may be minimal or even non-existent benefit. Of those, obviously, again, with severe depression got significant benefit. And so for me, Christy, this is a take-home point that not everyone clearly needs to be on antidepressant medication. and that simply opening a conversation, providing supportive care, and as we'll talk about later with our guest, perhaps with a professional.
Sure, therapy
exercise. Really can do a lot and go a long way, maybe even better than medication for people with mild depression.
Absolutely. So that's the end of our time for this segment of the show, but we've had a chance to talk a little bit about depression and sleep, antidepressant and medications.
Cell phone use and cancer and soy. Mm-hmm. And soy and protective effects against gynecological cancers. Well, that will conclude the Research That Matter portions of our show. After the break, we'll be talking with Dr. Donald Rosenstein about support services for patients and families faced with cancer. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Our featured topic today is support services for patients and families faced with cancer. You know, Adam, cancer can be such a scary diagnosis for both patients and families that we care for. And depending on the many different types and the prognoses and all the different factors that go into it, there's a lot of variation. But the one thing that holds true for any cancer diagnosis is that patients and families need support, both resources and help. Understanding and coping with the various aspects of that. So we're glad to have that conversation today.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Christy. You know, I was impressed ever since I was a medical student. I was able to do a writing report on psychosocial aspects of cancer, and just continuously being impressed with the not just the medical treatment, but the psychological, the social, the bio, all of the things that come to bear on it, and what we even as primary care doctors need to understand. So
right.
We're really thrilled to have with us today Dr. Donald Rosenstein, who is not only professor of psychiatry, but director of the new University of North Carolina Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. Dr. Rosenstein came to University of North Carolina after 17 years at the National Institute of Mental Health, where he directed not only clinical programs, but also was chief of the NIH's Psychiatry Consultation Liaison Service. After earning an undergraduate degree in psychology from Wesleyan University, he got his medical degree from Northwestern University School of Medicine and completing residency training in psychiatry at Yale University, which is a good university, I'm told. So very much welcome to the show, Dr. Rosenstein.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You know, one of the things that Adam and I are always so fascinated by are the stories that our guests have. And we'd love to hear your story about how you really were led down this road and landed in a place of being able to provide this sort of service for patients and families with cancer.
Well, I, like a lot of people who went through medical school and went into psychiatry, struggled with whether I wanted to do internal medicine or psychiatry. I always really liked internal medicine. And so the first part of my career was doing psychiatry with individuals who have medical illness, what's called consultation liaison psychiatry, people who are in the hospital for other reasons than mental illness. They may be there for heart disease or cancer or HIV/AIDS. And so I always found that the connection between medicine and psychiatry, someone's experience, was particularly interesting and rewarding. And over time, I kind of gravitated towards wanting to focus my attention on individuals with cancer.
Well, if we think about, I think today we might say, oh, yes, it's obvious that people, when they get cancer, have many other issues to worry about in addition to just the biological nature of the cancer itself. But I don't think it's always been like that. And again, I'm just thinking back to, a decade ago, that this was something incredibly novel. Help us understand, when did this realization and what led to this realization that there's all of these factors impacting on people and families with cancer?
Let me first start out just with a distinction, and that's the distinction between general supportive services for individuals and family members with cancer and a specific discipline that's called psycho-oncology, which talks about the psychological and social aspects of the diagnosis of cancer and the treatment of cancer, because I see psycho-oncology as one example of a larger effort to try to support patients and families
sure.
who are struggling with this. So Everyone needs information. So there's just access. There's such a wealth of information now on the web and other places. People feel overwhelmed when they first get a diagnosis. And the first thing a lot of people will tell you they do is they go to the web. And they're kind of inundated with both good and bad information, in my opinion. And so
Looking for the cure? Is that the
looking for understanding what it is?
All of that kind of, you know, words that their physicians may have used that they didn't understand, trying to find out what type of cancer they have and what their likelihood of survival is, what kinds of treatments are available, alternative treatments. So almost everyone I talk to who has access to the web will tell you that in the time between their initial evaluation and when they get the results of those tests back, they're online a lot.
Okay, so that's a given.
Right.
What's not a given?
So what's not a given is trying to understand what the individual needs are of patients and their family members. And what is humbling being in this business is that there is no kind of uniform response to a diagnosis of cancer. And some people somehow take this in stride and never seem to have particular difficulties coping with it. Other people seem to fall apart immediately, but you can't make assumptions about what is in someone's head, what it means to them, what their associations are, what their, you know, their experience with family members has been. And so usually it's a good idea to ask people how they're doing early on so that you can get a better sense of what in particular they're struggling with. It's not a given to assume anything about what someone's response is going to be to cancer.
And so that's good advice for us as primary care doctors when we're having these conversations or seeing somebody in follow-up to make sure we don't make assumptions that just because we know this particular cancer might be treatable that they're responding a certain way. And I guess that's also good advice for family members who might make assumptions that, oh, well, you know, my sister had that too and she did fine, so my other sister must be fine too.
Right. And one of the most interesting parts about my work is when the needs of a patient may not necessarily align perfectly with the needs of family members. So sometimes you'll have a husband or a wife who somehow thinks that their role is meant to be a cheerleader at all costs. And sometimes that can cause tension when someone really is having a down day and doesn't want to be thinking, you know, optimistically 24/7. And so sometimes we help negotiate those differences as well.
Well, help me, you know, I want to ask another question here because this is actually, you know, I've got a really good friend as well as a very close family member now with breast cancer. Relatively young women who undergoing surgery and chemotherapy and radiation therapy. One of the things I'm a little bit unclear about as a close friend and as a family member is my role, you know, and because I can't really know, as you just indicated, every patient is different how they process and do. And so sometimes it's unclear to me what should be my role, if anything, in their care, treatment, friend, patient advocate. What kind of advice would you give to someone like myself who's trying to be not only a good friend, but a good family member? And also, I'm a family doc, so it makes it's even confusing in my own mind.
Right. So there are a lot of ways to get it right and a lot of ways to get it wrong. And
help me.
I think the first bit of advice I would give is to kind of no sudden movements. You know, you've been friends with people, you know, with some of these individuals you've been talking about for a while. And so you don't want any kind of radical departure. You don't want to go from being a friend to being a doctor all of a sudden, or you don't want to go from being someone who normally goes out for a run or, you know, has some other kind of interaction and then changes that to being, you know, more of a counseling situation. I think that you want to stay who you are to that person because a lot of things are changing, and I imagine that for a lot of people who have this diagnosis, their world changes dramatically in all sorts of ways. It's good to know that you as a friend are the same you've been, you know, the day before that diagnosis came. And then after that, I would just follow the lead of your friend to find out what would be helpful. Sometimes they may want to talk about the cancer in great length. Sometimes that's the last thing in the world on their mind. And what they want is a friend who will take their mind off of it for a few hours.
And I would imagine it'd be acceptable to ask that person, what do you need from me?
Right.
You know, how can I best be your your family member, but I'm also a doctor. And I mean, sometimes having that open conversation, I would imagine, could be helpful. Do you advise that?
Absolutely. And it's also a moving target. So what may work at one phase may not work at another time. And I just think that, you know, if your heart's in the right place, that message will come across more than anything else. Is just, you know, to say I want to be helpful in whatever way I can. And it may just be bringing a meal, you know, during chemotherapy, or you know, driving someone to and from an appointment. It doesn't have to be anything profound. It doesn't have to be anything psychologically sophisticated. What it is showing up and letting someone know that you care about them and you want to try to help them through. Sometimes the smallest things are what really help the most.
Well, you know, I think that's actually really important advice, because it also takes some pressure off maybe the family member or the caregiver or the friend feeling like you have to, or that you're obligated, or that you really want to do so much more, and to know that maybe a small thing, maybe just the phone call or the email in and of itself is doing enough or doing something. And right. Versus feeling like you can't do anything.
Even a simple kindness. And that's one of the main things that I wanted to kind of drive home today, is that the majority of individuals who have cancer, they cope quite well. A smaller percentage of people really struggle in a lot of ways and need more expert help. But for the most part, people are quite resilient. And even though it's a big hit and it takes a while to absorb that hit with the help of friends and family members, they do okay. And it doesn't take any kind of extraordinary interventions.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to talking with you about the comprehensive cancer support program that you have. But we do need to take a short break. But when we return, Adam and I will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Donald Rosenstein, about support services for patients and families dealing with cancer. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Donald Rosenstein about how patients and family members deal with new cancer diagnoses and the things that are useful and maybe sometimes not as useful to hear from those who care for them. And one of the questions that comes up, Dr. Rosenstein, is what are some of the red flags that maybe you said most people deal with this really well, but there are those who have real problems. I've seen them, but what are the things that signify that this might be something different and they really need some additional resources such as those you provide?
Right. So one thing is that I think everyone is entitled to some time to fall apart initially and then figure out how they can gather up their own resources and move forward. And so what I try to do to answer that question is look at symptoms that are getting in the way of sleeping, getting in the way of thinking clearly, getting in the way of organizing activities, symptoms that may impair taking your medicines the right way, or if you're so anxious that you start missing appointments. So the issue has to do with function. And when someone is so anxious, so tearful, so upset that they can't get through a conversation with someone that they care about without bursting into tears, when they can't sleep through the night, when they are so depressed that they can't eat, those are the kinds of targeted symptoms that we try to address with talk therapies and with wellness approaches and also with medication sometimes.
And so I would imagine that those types of symptoms of things that can really get in the way of your ability to function, that those symptoms could happen to the very patient who received the diagnosis. But I can imagine some scenarios, and I've seen these with my patients, where it might be the patient's wife or the patient's daughter who is so affected by this new diagnosis that they might be the one to potentially refer to your services.
Absolutely. And it's not just with the initial diagnosis and the initial days and weeks of treatment. It's any time throughout the whole treatment cycle. I just was working with a patient and his wife, and you know, she had been in the hospital for weeks on end, sleeping in the hospital. She was absolutely exhausted, and she was getting to the point where she really wasn't able to do the things that she wanted to do and needed to do to help her husband get ready to go home and take care of things. And so very often, the best way to help a patient with cancer is to help the caregiver who's doing everything they can to kind of support someone they love.
What about different types of cancer? In your experience, do different types of cancers play out differently in terms of how people utilize support services or the need for them? And I'm just thinking about in my own work doing smoking cessation that people with lung cancer, it seems to me that there oftentimes there's a lot more guilt associated with that versus maybe something like breast cancer where maybe there's a natural larger support network. I don't know. I'm just asking.
It's a great question. I think that some of this has to do with societal expectations and biases. Some of it has to do with individual thoughts about, you know, what you may have done that brought this on. And one of my pet peeves is kind of an exaggeration in the pop literature of certain personality types that may or may not be associated with, you know, the development of cancer, whether you respond to it and whether you suppress your anger and whether, you know, you do other things and try, you know, try to minimize your stress. I mean, look, we know that there are behaviors that are associated with the greater risk of cancer, smoking, sun exposure, and so on. But there are a lot of cases where people develop cancer, and some of these very cancers you mentioned, where it's not a result of the behavior. And even if it is, I don't see how guilt helps in any way. And so I think that there are certainly—
So that becomes another symptom, like you mentioned before, if it's interfering with sleep. If guilt is interfering with some element, then you're going to be really working with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, I see my role and the role of the members of the team in the cancer support program is doing everything we can to help someone get through a successful treatment of their cancer. And if that is addressing and minimizing some of these notions that they're responsible in some way for what happened to them, then that's where we target our efforts.
So tell us a little bit more about your program. So once we've identified a patient or a family member who's having some of these symptoms of guilt or problems of sleep or inability to maintain, you know, the things they need to do and to carry forward in their daily activities, how do we refer them to you, and what is the range of services that you provide for people?
Well, I'm extraordinarily excited about what we're putting in place at UNC at this point. I think the leadership of the Cancer Hospital and the Limeburger Comprehensive Cancer Center and the Department of Psychiatry was really forward-thinking in trying to put together the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. And what that is an umbrella organization that ties together several different support programs to try to help patients and family members. It includes our Patient and Family Resource Center, where people can check out a book from a very large collection of books about cancer. They can go online with help from staff to try to sort out what is relevant information from what is kind of poorly kind of researched information on the web. We have a boutique with hats and wigs and scarves to help individuals who are going through chemotherapy look better and feel better, and nutritional programs that we have there.
Men and women, right?
Men and women, both.
Yeah, good.
And so that's the Patient and Family Resource Center. And then we also have the Psycho-Oncology Consultation Service, psychological counseling, psychiatric assessment, couples counseling, family counseling. We help parents who have kids with cancer and so on.
These are people only just diagnosed, or can it be people who were diagnosed a year or 2 years ago and now all of a sudden they're having problems?
Both. We have a survivorship program. We are supported by the Live Strong Survivorship Network, and we're a center of excellence in the Lance Armstrong Foundation Survivorship Network. We're also funded by the Jimmy Valvano Foundation, and we're increasingly addressing our efforts at what happens after active treatment. How do you live with cancer going forward? We have integrative medicine services that we're putting in place, and we're excited about that. We have—
Like what?
Like yoga and massage therapy and lymphedema therapy and biofeedback and mindfulness programs. We have a symptom management clinic that we run with the palliative care service at the hospital, looking at pain management and chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. We are putting in place a telemedicine program where we can do some of these same, provide some of these same services to remote areas of North Carolina. So the short answer, that was a long answer, I'm sorry, but the short
answer
to what
to offer.
Cancer Support Program offers is what we hope is a well-integrated approach so that at the very least, we can make this experience a little less awful for patients. And when we really get it right, I think we can be helpful in people actually having a pretty transformative experience where they think differently about themselves and their lives and their relationships and believe it or not, grow through the cancer experience.
And is this something that insurances usually will cover in terms of services, or is cost a barrier at all?
It's uneven. So first of all, we provide a lot of our services free of charge. Our support groups that we offer and a program called Look Good, Feel Better. Some of the educational and nutritional programs are all free of charge. Some of the expert consultations with psychiatrists and psychologists, there is a fee for that, and insurance does cover that
in
most cases, but it's uneven. Yoga is not covered, and massage therapy is not covered by most third-party.
I know that, I would say the quality of care clearly, even if the quantity of life is extended or not with some of the things, the quality is a huge factor here. And I think it's a paradigm shifting one, not only for patients, but I think it's for providers, Christy. You know, having been in medicine now for almost 20 years, you know, this is changing the way I think hopefully doctors in the cancer center and even primary care doctors can work together and come together. So I really have to applaud you for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us today and for all you're doing for our patients and community.
Is there a number where they can call if people want to find out more information?
If I can, yeah, let me give you one main number for the Cancer Support Program, which is 919-843-0680. And that will get you to the Patient and Family Resource Center, and the staff there can answer any questions about the Comprehensive Cancer Support Program.
That's 843-0680.
0680.
Okay, thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Donald Rosenstein of the UNC Comprehensive Cancer Support Program. And we do need to wrap up, but following the break, coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your questions, experiences, and attitudes.
And we want you to write us about your experiences and give us your questions. We'll try to address these on an upcoming show and give you our thoughts and opinions. Send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can also send them to us via Twitter, and a lot of you are listening and following us on Twitter, so feel free to send it to us that way as well.
Yep. We'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read us some recent patient questions.
Dear Dr. Page and Dr. Goldstein, I've got Raynaud's, which is usually pretty manageable, but in the past few weeks I'm having some serious toe problems, especially in my right foot. At times it feels like needles poking in them. They're swollen most of the time, which means I can pretty much only wear my very attractive dance goes. They ache a lot, some skin is peeling, and if I happen to knock one of them or a child steps on them, the pain is excruciating. I get these problems pretty much every winter to some degree, but it seems to be getting worse. Do you know who I could see that could possibly offer me some help? Would that be you or someone that specializes in circulation issues? Whatever I'm doing right now just isn't keeping the problem to a manageable level.
Great
question.
Thank you question.
For your multiple questions.
Yes, this lots is a, of questions.
This is a really difficult problem that you're experiencing. And so I know that first off, you know, particularly with all the cold weather that we've had in December and January, that this is very, very difficult time of year for people, particularly if they have Raynaud's, but a lot of other people who have poor circulation.
Yeah, and I guess we should start off by defining for other folks who might be listening what we're talking about. And this is where people have an exaggerated response in their blood vessels to cold temperature or sometimes stress. And it can present itself as having real color changes, almost purple changes of the skin of your fingers and even toes.
And it can happen really on exposure to cold acutely, or even, you know, even kind of at a temperature where a lot of people, like in indoors, you know, people might be comfortable at a 65, 68 degree, but you, at that temperature, your hands and feet might really get really cold and change that purplish color, and you really have reduced circulation, and that can and usually is painful.
So sometimes this is a phenomenon that happens on its own, but sometimes it can be related to an underlying medical problem like lupus or scleroderma, and there are a variety of other causes. And so for you, the person who's so kindly writing to us, without knowing more about that diagnosis and whether or not there's an underlying disorder, answering your question about who to see or who to talk with can be a little bit tricky. But we do have some general advice.
Yeah, well, and the first things is I would see anyone who knows something about Raynaud's or who is willing to look up about Raynaud's and work with you, because the data is out there, if indeed this is Raynaud's. This isn't rocket science in terms of things that you can do, but working with a provider who's willing to become educated if they're not already. There are some specialists that do see more of these cases, but I would really start with a primary care physician who can work with you.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, there's some general advice like trying to avoid your triggers, to wear gloves and good socks, and even explore with your doctor potential medications that can reduce that spasm of the blood vessels. But I would start with your primary care doctor and then from there help decide based on what's going on who the next person to see would be if that primary doctor has already sort of reached their level of expertise.
Yeah, one of the big things in this cold weather is keeping the hands and feet warm. So again, things like mittens will work sometimes better than gloves because it really traps heat more. You can use these hand warmers or these feet warmers, again, to really kind of keep those feet warm. Wool sometimes can be more insulating than cotton, particularly if cotton gets wet and sweaty, is very poor insulation. So some environmental measures can be very helpful.
Right. So hopefully that's a start for you. I do hope that you will engage with your primary doctor and hope that your symptoms get better soon.
Julie, what's our very next house call?
Why is it that pregnant women aren't supposed to eat deli meats?
That's a really good question, and one that I asked too when I was pregnant. There are a lot of groups that recommend that pregnant women avoid cold deli meats, and that's really an effort to try to help pregnant women avoid the possibility of getting a bacteria called Listeria. And that, if you get it when you're pregnant, can make you very sick and could also even lead to miscarriage.
And it's also not just deli meats in terms of raw things. Things like sushi would also probably be things that we would not encourage people to eat during pregnancy.
Yeah, there's a whole list that you can find online and that some practices will give out to their prenatal patients about you know, nutritional strategies. And really, it's an effort to try to prevent catching bacteria and viruses even that can be transmitted through food. So, the general advice that I say is, you know, wash your hands, cook the food if you can, and try to avoid raw foods in general.
Yeah, I don't think the 30-second rule when foods drop on the floor really counts during pregnancy, does it, Christy? I think when it drops on the floor, it's gone.
That's probably true. But, you know, talk with your doctor about ways to still eat well in pregnancy without having to be so obsessed, really, with all the list of things you can't eat, you know.
You can get the tempura sushi, the cooked
sushi. Oh, yeah,
sushi
and
there.
Just ask for no raw eggs. That's what I always did. But
Julie, what's our very next house call?
Sometimes one of my eyes twitches uncontrollably for several minutes. It doesn't hurt and my vision doesn't change. I try to rub it to make it stop, but that doesn't seem to do much. It just goes away after a few minutes without really doing anything to make it stop, and then I might notice it again months later. Is this something I should be worried about, and is there anything I can do to stop it?
That's a really interesting question. And, you know, I've had that over the last couple years some, so I relate to what it's like, and it's not a necessarily fun sensation because you're wondering, like, what's going on?
Yeah, I've actually had that happen to me, too. Funny that it's happened to both of us. And it does feel weird if you're not trying to you know, contract that muscle where the nerve, it's almost like the nerve is just firing and kind of irritated there.
Yeah, and one of the things I've discovered is that this happens like many things in medicine, when you actually perhaps aren't doing the right things for yourself in terms of perhaps sleep and sometimes diet. So for me,
if I haven't been getting a whole lot of sleep, and particularly if I'm drinking too much caffeine or caffeinated beverages, even though I like my coffee, Christy, I can sometimes get a little bit of a twitching sensation, and it's not usually stress as much as it is sleep and caffeine. What about for you? Do you know?
Yeah, for me, it's often been stress-related. Like, that's been a sign that maybe I'm tired and a little stressed and need to tend to myself. And then it just goes away the way that you're describing. I would say if you have any other symptoms like numbness or tingling or vision changes, you said you didn't, but if you had any other thing, I would definitely have a low threshold to go and talk with your doctor about it, because it could be something more serious than what I think you're talking about.
Well, real quickly, Julie, what's our very last house call question today?
This is really a dental question, but one I've been meaning to ask. How soon should I start flossing my kids' teeth?
Great question. Not necessarily our area of expertise, but quickly we can tell you that dental care for kids is important, and the thinking now is that the health of those baby teeth is linked to the health of the permanent teeth, and oral health matters.
And, you know, most dentists would recommend as soon as that the teeth have, you know, touching each other, that you really would start flossing. And I think the habit of flossing is one that we should encourage and become a lifelong habit. And I know that my kids have gotten into the habit much greater because they've been introduced at much earlier ages than I was, and it becomes more difficult. So no real downside, only upside. The earlier, the better.
Yep. And the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend that you take your kids to see the dentist even as early as age one.
Well, that's going to conclude House Calls, Christy, but we've talked about some really interesting things today, things like kids flossing and encouraging it, and pregnant women, and
eating cooked
things, and Raynaud's disease, and things people can do in the environment. And finally, what else do we – anything else we talked about? Oh, the twitching of the eye.
Oh, yeah.
We're not winking at each other, but we want to get more sleep and maybe a little less caffeine at times.
So thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want us to share your questions and experiences by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And you can also follow us on Twitter.
And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer, Julie Steiner, and our great guest today, Dr. Donald Rosenstein. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.